Dr. Jonathan Dudley is the author of the book Broken Words, The Abuse of Science and Faith in American Politics. Thanks to his invaluable analysis of the way evangelical Christianity has radically changed its stand on issues like abortion and done so in our lifetimes, he's the person I wanted to talk to about some of the timeless values at the heart of two cases the Supreme Court has agreed to hear. Jonathan, it's great to have you back with us on State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be back.
Would you briefly refresh the memories of our listeners about the changes in the seminal teachings on abortion that you describe in your book?
I grew up in the evangelical community, and growing up, I had always believed that, you know, the Bible clearly says that life begins at conception, and this is the Christian position, and it's what Christians have always believed. When I went to school at Yale Divinity School and started actually really studying this history, I was very surprised to learn that, in fact, this is a very recent belief in both the Catholic and the evangelical traditions. For most of Christian history, the Catholic tradition has held that life begins at formation, which is when the developing fetal body begins to have brain activity and to have organs formed. And it was thought that life only begins at that point because that's when the soul can be infused. And the change to conception in the Catholic tradition actually occurred in the mid-1800s for a variety of complex reasons I talk about in my book. But perhaps most interesting for our purposes is how evangelical thinking has evolved on abortion. One thing that most people don't know is that in the late 1960s and early 1970s, most evangelical leaders actually supported looser abortion laws. And they did so in large part because there was a widespread belief among evangelical theologians and scholars that the Bible teaches that life begins at birth. And this is based on a verse in Exodus, where it was interpreted at the time, at least, as suggesting that if a man hits a pregnant woman and she miscarries, then the penalty is a fine. But if the pregnant woman dies, then it's life for life. Evangelical scholars took this as suggesting a difference in the moral value of fetal life versus maternal life. And in the late 1960s, the magazine Christianity Today, the main evangelical magazine, hosted a symposium of evangelical leaders from around the country and also published a special issue on contraception and abortion, in which the leading article in that issue, authored by Bruce Watke from Dallas Theological Seminary, argued that the Bible plainly teaches that life begins at birth based on this Exodus 21 passage.
You may recall, I came out of that same tradition. Were you staggered at that, or did you remember some of that as I do?
I did not know any of that because I'm still a fairly young guy, so I wasn't born at the time. I was born in the mid-1980s when the evangelical right had kind of taken over, and the shift in thinking had already occurred. So, while I was growing up, I had assumed it was always that way.
I see.
So I was shocked when I was doing this research.
I remember sitting in Southern Baptist Convention's annual sessions, and there was a very progressive resolution every year on abortion. So what you're pointing out, a lot of older people ought to remember, but it is important to remember it now.
I think there are a few reasons that this is so interesting and significant. I mean, on the one hand, you could say, well, evangelicals have changed their thinking on abortion. That doesn't necessarily mean their thinking is wrong, and that's true.
Right.
Over the course of the 1970s, there was this massive shift from believing the Bible clearly teaches that life begins at birth and generally supporting looser abortion laws to around 1980, thinking the Bible clearly teaches that life begins at conception. In fact, Jerry Falwell started teaching on abortion and speaking out against it and writing on it in the late 1970s. And in his main book, where he first really discusses abortion in a chapter called The Right to Life, he argues that the Bible clearly teaches that life begins at conception based on Psalm 139. And so the reason that I think evangelicals began interpreting the Bible that way is because Catholics had held the position previously that life begins at conception for reasons that weren't biblical, but were based on analytic philosophy and science. And so because evangelicals kind of, around the late 1960s, while evangelicals still had these more liberal views on abortion, Catholics had already developed more conservative views from the change in doctrine that occurred in Catholicism in the mid-1800s. So that immediately after Roe v. Wade, while evangelicals still weren't that concerned, Catholics formed the National Right to Life Committee. They started a lot of activism. In the mid-1970s, evangelicals began being more politically active on topics like combating feminism, combating homosexuality. And they eventually begin to see abortion as one of the elements of the sexual revolution that concerned them. And Catholics had kind of established the vocabulary and the beliefs that characterized the anti-abortion position. So as evangelicals started cooperating with them, they started kind of reinterpreting the Bible as teaching what Catholics had already established as the anti-abortion position.
I see. I want to get to the application of this to what we see happening right now. The Supreme Court, as you know, has agreed to hear arguments in two cases that involve private businesses claiming religious exemptions to the Affordable Care Act's reproductive health mandate. While the Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties cases differ, they share the principle of a company being able to have a religious conscience. Now, how much more complicated do things get when some of the convictions are relatively arbitrary based on the recent history and the changes in it?
Yeah, well, that kind of gets back to the significance of the historical shift.
Right.
Just because people change their minds doesn't mean they're wrong. I think what's problematic is when evangelicals and other Christians come out saying that this is so clearly what the Bible teaches that a reasonable person can't disagree. Because I think that's hard to maintain when those very same leaders held the complete opposite position several decades ago.
Yeah.
Clearly, the Bible is not clear enough on abortion that there's only one reasonable interpretation if nearly all current religious right leaders didn't think the Bible teaches that around, say, even as late as 1970. So it kind of undermines the claim that the Bible has a clear position on this issue. It also undermines the claim that the religious right's position on this issue flows from just historic Christian doctrine or that they're just defending traditional Christian beliefs. While Christians have always been morally opposed to abortion, the idea that it's murder from conception onward, which is really the idea that justifies making it illegal, is actually pretty recent. You can be morally opposed to abortion, as Christians historically have been, without believing it's murder from conception, and therefore you can support it being legal, even if you think it's morally wrong.
Right.
So the significance of this shift is that by making abortion murder, it provides a very strong legal basis to make it illegal.
Well, Jonathan, you're also a medical doctor. As you've listened to these issues being debated, is there glaring medical misinformation that you're hearing that muddies the waters even further?
I think there's a lot of medical misinformation. I think you see a lot of the same tendencies that you see in the religious right on issues like intelligent design or evolution or global warming. There's a tendency to kind of, instead of asking, like, what's the truth about the situation, there's a tendency to kind of say, okay, our position is this. Now let's go rummage around in medical journals to find quotes that support this position. And one good example of this recently is with the fetal pain legislation. There's been a push to outlaw abortions starting at 20 weeks because many proponents on the religious right claim that this is when fetuses can first start to feel pain, where in fact there is roughly a medical consensus that places it much later. And a lot of the arguments made for saying that fetal pain begins at 20 weeks are based on you know, taking things out of context or kind of just finding quotes that seem to support your position, but mm-hmm. even if the authors actually don't. So yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of pseudoscience of the sort that you see elsewhere propagated by the religious right.
You make a really compelling case in your book that political considerations have contributed significantly to the change in doctrine among some conservative Christian denominations. Do you see a political component to the current birth control debates going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can understand a lot of the reaction against the idea that employers should provide health care as stemming, in addition to just Christian moral beliefs about contraception and abortion. I think a lot of it also stems from hostility towards big government mm-hmm. that isn't necessarily a feature unique to the Christian tradition, but that has come as for a variety of, you know, historical factors to characterize a lot of conservative Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, with the government, you know, they see it as kind of intervening in our reproductive choices by requiring this. I think that a lot of that stems more from idiosyncratic political beliefs that aren't Christian but happen to characterize a lot of Christians and be held by a lot of Christians.
Yeah.
Not so much by uniquely Christian beliefs. So.
I have the feeling that the justices on the Supreme Court would do well to read your book. Because
I'd recommend that as well.
<They're>,
very generous.
Well, because there is also this mischaracterization that you've really challenged about what the history is, and they may be dealing with what they think's history, and it's not history at all. When the dust settles, who do you think will be the winners and losers in this matter?
It is somewhat hard to predict where the court will go, but given that five of the justices tend to have more conservative views on this issue. Mm-hmm. I think it's likely that there will be a ruling in favor of religious conservatives yeah. on this topic. And I'm not entirely sure what will happen after that. I mean, it seems to me, at least, you know, just from my perspective, very unfair that someone who is not a Catholic but working for a major Catholic organization should not be able to have contraception covered in their health plan
yeah.
simply because of the employer's personal beliefs.
Right.
I mean, on the one hand, you can think, well, you know, just getting condoms isn't that expensive. But on the other hand, some of the more effective approaches, like condoms are cheap, but they're not that effective. Some of the mm-hmm. more effective ones are intrauterine devices mm-hmm. that have a less than 1% failure rate, whereas condoms have about 20%. Those are very expensive. They can be up to $1,000. And it can be hard for a lot of the people who really need birth control the most, poorer people who are don't have the resources to support a family to have access to those if they're not covered. So I think it could disproportionately harm poor people and result in more unwanted pregnancies and, ironically, more abortions.
I actually think that is a conservative point of view, but it's a conservative point of view held by a lot of progressive thinkers as well, because we're dealing there with reality and not ideology. Jonathan
yeah.
Dudley is the author of the book Broken Words, The Abuse of Science and Faith in American Politics. He's a graduate of Yale Divinity School who's also a medical doctor. And so he brings a unique and valuable perspective to the way health, religion, and ethics are impacting each other in today's political environment. Jonathan, it's always great to talk with you. I thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
It's great to be here anytime.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. One of the things I love about State of Belief Radio is that we take topics that you hear talked about in a lot of other places, but not like this. And you get into some details here that you don't get into at other places. I'm grateful for the people that were on the show today and how much they helped us understand some of these matters that are in the public eye. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show. hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. We would love that. Stay in touch with us throughout the week on Facebook and Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. We encourage you to tell others about this show. The things we've talked about today are topics that need to be talked about by every person in this nation. It's a time to share values, perspectives, encourage others to listen so they can be a part of the conversation. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy, that State of Belief.